Welcome on to the Dunked On Basketball podcast, where we have half of the finals matchup set. The Cleveland Cavaliers, 118-88 winners over the Hawks. A game, I'm here with Danny LaRue, not close.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the best way to describe it. The Cavs came out swinging, and they just kept on going. It was one of those games that it felt like it was completely over at halftime.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe Atlanta, they may have prepared without Kyrie, you know, thinking that Kyrie wasn't going to play, and then to have him come out, and you know, and frankly, if I were them, I probably would have prepared the same way, because you're having enough trouble already. You didn't think he was going to play with them up 3-0, so and you want to get enough, as much rest for him as you possibly can. But then when he came out and he hit his first five shots or something like that, and they must have just been completely demoralized by that. I mean, this is deck chairs on the Titanic at this point, but Coach Bud started off with Teague on Kyrie. Probably should have gone with Bazemore, but I guess you want to see what Kyrie has first. You know, if it was the shell of himself Kyrie that had been playing earlier in the series, then maybe you're fine with Teague and you want to avoid the cross match. But that was an issue. And then Kyrie, you know, never got attacked defensively at all because they could just hide him on Bazemore. And then the Hawks just, you know, they couldn't stop the Cavs and they couldn't hit any shots. 2 of 14 from three. I mean, that's the biggest thing. They just could not hit a three-pointer in this series.
And another dynamic, there are a few things we can talk about with Kyrie, is I didn't know until after the game that Matthew Dellavedova was sick. And I don't think that factored into the decision of whether you play Kyrie or not, because I feel like that's a greater decision that involves more complications. But you think about how different this game would have been if he didn't play, considering that factor as well.
Yeah, they might only won by 25.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, but I mean, this Hawks team, when you really think about the shooting that they had, you know, Millsap from three, Korver, 49%, he was out for much of the series. Damari Carroll shot almost 40%. He was a shell of himself after that game one injury. And then you've got, you know, Paul Millsap was only really 36%. He could not get it going at all from long range in the series. That really hurt them. He had a ton of open looks that he just couldn't convert. Schroeder somehow was 35% from long range during the regular year. Certainly didn't look like that type of player in this series. Teague, 34%, not at all reliable. And so when you get there, and all those guys really, except for Carroll and Korver, are kind of more three-point takers than three-point makers. And that's valuable to be a three-point taker, but when they just keep giving it to you and you can't make it, and they, you know, the Cavs are shutting off the rim inside, then you're in trouble.
Yeah, and one of the big questions with this series and with this playoff run is how repeatable the success that the Hawks had in the regular season is, both in the regular season and in the postseason, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later, but it's a really complicated question in a lot of ways, just because they're doing it in a different way. But I feel like there is definitely middle ground, but one of the things that was frustrating in these playoffs is that we never saw at any point in my, from what I can recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, we never saw that January to March, let's say, Hawks team at all.
Game six against the Nets was really the only time they got it going in that fashion. And then they also, they had that, I think I want to say it was game three. Against the Wizards when
That's
they had
right.
65 points in the first half. Those are really the only two times that we saw them get it going, and there was kind of this cathartic, all right, finally they're getting back to it, and then, you know, it turned out to be entirely fleeting.
Yeah. One of the things that you brought up during the game, and I think it's one of the tactical notes that is interesting as we move forward, is about trapping. You want to break people through that?
Yeah, I mean, and it was Cleveland, their bigs, Mozgov and Thompson, not people who are really renowned for making plays off the dribble. Thompson may be a little underrated in that facet, as we talked about. He was someone who got the ball a little bit more and, you know, was able to attack with a modicum of efficiency out of the mid post in previous iterations of his career before they were actually any good. But when you consider all the other options on the floor, I thought that blitzing the pick and roll, whether it's Kyrie or LeBron, if the four man or the five man was setting it, you might as well just blitz them and force them to throw it on the short roll to someone like Mozgov or Thompson, neither of whom are an amazing passer or anything, and say, all right, now you're going to have to make a play. We're going to cover up the shooters. You know, if you have a brief two-on-one as we scramble to get back, you know, catching the ball at the free throw line or near the top of the key, we're fine with that. That's going to be the poison that we're going to deal with. And they finally started doing more of that, actually just as the Bulls did towards the end of their series when they weren't able to stop LeBron from getting to the basket or Kyrie from getting to the basket. And, you know, for the Bulls, they weren't able to execute it that well because it's not their base defense. Atlanta has a little bit more mobility, at least, you know, when they're healthy. And that worked a little bit, but, I mean, they still gave up a buck 18. And I don't think, you know, they got swept. Like, there wasn't any strategic adjustment that was going to win them this series. But I think that that's good. It'll be interesting to see whether Golden State goes to that. Andrew Bogut doesn't really come out on the perimeter. But, you know, Draymond Green certainly is someone who could.
Yeah, and
if they don't just switch it.
Yeah, and Houston will have their own dynamics with everything as well. So either way, I think it's something that they have to consider whether they, you know, I don't think it's a panacea of anything. You know, it's just an interesting option that you have on the table.
Yeah, and I wouldn't expect Golden State to start with that unless they start having trouble because their base defense is so good. But anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. It looks like we're going to have quite a bit of time. Sorry, Houston fans. I fully expect them to not win tomorrow, but, you know, stranger things have happened, at least for one game. But, you know, we'll have plenty of time to talk, preview the finals. But, yeah, I mean, what I want to ask you, and don't worry, Cleveland fans, we're going to be giving you all kinds of credit. Don't get salty. There's definitely a little bit of a Twitter presence from Cleveland fans when I tried to say, you know, maybe this wasn't the you know, the people who are criticizing the Hawks for, like, laying down or something need to consider, like, just how injured they were. And then, of course, you know, just get destroyed by Cleveland Twitter saying, oh, yeah, well, we were so injured, blah, blah. And, like, yeah, guess what? The reason why everyone is saying the Hawks laid down is because they lost to this team that was so injured. Like, the whole it's reacting to the fact that they're injured. Like, making that statement in and of itself is giving credit to the fact that Cleveland is so injured. But in any event, you know, I think I got retweeted by Anna Horford, and people wrote some really awful things that were rather disappointing. But in any event, that's not why people tuned into this, but it was a little remarkable that, you know, as more people really seem to be engaging on Twitter, that you see that kind of stuff. It's disappointing.
Yeah, it definitely is. And the context matters here a lot on both sides. I mean, yet clearly the Cavs were missing some of the best players, and so they got contributions from Kyrie Irving at small moments in this series. But the Hawks starting five, I mean, there was a report tonight, I believe, that Millsap has something that he's going to be dealing with as well. And so
yeah, Howard Beck wrote a column today. And we should talk about this, too. His premise was, or I don't know if it was his premise, but he asked the Hawks about, you know, does this invalidate basically this result invalidate this sort of, you know, five player seamless, you know, no superstar approach? And of course, they all said it doesn't. And one of the things he noted was that Millsap may have to have surgery on his shoulder, which is, as you'll recall, was bruised, and he tried to come back at the end of the regular season, but, you know, really has not looked like himself. And his shooting has obviously not been great either. You don't know how much of that is that he's not as good of a shooter as we thought, or how much is the shoulder, or whatever.
Yeah, and do you want to talk about the bigger question now?
Yeah, of whether, like, they can actually keep this going.
I think that it's a very weird question, because you're not really choosing between the two. What the Hawks have is making the best of a situation that you have. Not every team in the league can have a superstar, and so they've built a really strong team with excellent players. They had, I believe, four guys make the All-Star team in a week in Eastern Conference, but still. And they played really well. If they could get LeBron James, I'm sure they would be happy to get LeBron James, but there aren't enough superstars in the league. I think that their strategy can work, but a team with more aggregate talent can certainly exist, and they would have an advantage.
Yeah, and that's actually Ryan Russillo and Zach Lowe are both saying that on their podcast today, which is excellent. You guys should listen to that one. Way higher production values if you're into that sort of thing. But anyway, yeah, to me, when we're talking about, all right, you know, they had a great regular season. they're much better than they were before. I mean, they tried for the superstars. They didn't get them. Nobody wanted to go play in Atlanta. You know, they managed to sell out the arena and get the city excited about Hawks basketball that, you know, Phillips Arena is usually a mausoleum, even when they're making those runs into the second round, for so many years in the latter part of the 2000s, there wasn't this level of excitement. So, I mean, I think you just kind of have to stay the course if you're them, try and bring people back. We don't need to get into the mechanics of how they're going to do that. But I guess the question is, do we think that they can, if they do bring the band back, can they repeat this level of performance next year? Or is this just a lucky season that, they're just going to fall back into the Eastern Conference pack next year?
I would say on the aggregate, their players outperformed their talent level, but not so substantially that it was a fluke in that sense. I think that it would be the word fluke is used really frequently in sports, and I think that it's misused. In this case, they are a little bit worse than they played, and they had a really great season. So I think they'll downgrade maybe a degree or two, and it will also be impacted by the aggregate quality in the East. Will other teams give them a run for their money? But I don't think they'll be substantially worse. I still think they'll be a top three seed, depending on the health of everyone else.
So there's two components to this to me. One is, were they just lucky this year? And they were a 55-win team when you consider their Pythagorean record, which it was a concept that was started in baseball. Basically, what it derives from, for those who don't know, is when you look at a team's point differential, that is actually more predictive of how good they are and what their future performance will be than wins and losses. Because, you know, if you think about it, if one team wins two games and one is by 20 points and, you know, they win them both by 20 and another team wins two games by 2 points, obviously the team that wins by 20 is a better team. So when you consider that, they really only should have won 55 games this year, but when you consider their point differential. So that's kind of starting from step one. Step two, they were extraordinarily healthy among their starting five this year, obviously, until the playoffs, when they, you know, that regressed in a big way. Step three is now you have to consider, all right, when we consider that for this year, now look at next year, how old are those guys going to be? Can we expect these guys to improve or not? And really, on this roster, the only guy I think who's an individual that you expect to play any better next year, potentially, would, at least among the starters, would be Teague. Off the bench, maybe Schroeder, you could see taking a pretty big leap. But, you know, Teague is already a guy who's going to improve. So, and Schroeder backs him up. So Korver is going to be 34. He's going to be coming off what sounds very much like a lengthy rehabilitation for his ankle. Millsap, 30. Damari Carroll, 30. You know, for those who don't know, primes in the NBA usually go from about 25 to 27. Unless you're a superstar, there's some evidence that superstars may maintain their primes a little bit longer. But, you know, both Millsap and Korver, you could say, had career years this year. Carroll had a career year, too. So you would expect that all those guys are going to regress a little bit. Horford is, he's kind of beyond his prime a little bit, too. So it's hard to say that individually these guys are going to play as well last year or next year as they did last year. And then you consider the fact that they all kind of regressed a little bit in the playoffs too, and just individually didn't play well enough. I mean, I think that was ultimately what it boiled down to, is that these guys just on an individual level didn't perform the way they did in the regular season. It wasn't so much schematic. It wasn't anything like that. They just couldn't get it done.
Yeah, and the looks do change in the postseason, the way that teams defend change, and I think they played in a way that was closer to their talent level in the playoffs. Would you agree, or would you say that the regular season was closer to this team, what this team is?
It's tough to say. When we talked about their shooting, I think you had guys who are not knockdown shooters who, when the ball's really hopping and they're in rhythm, maybe they can knock them down a little bit better than, you know, when you're in the playoff crucible and you know that you have to knock these down because that's what the defense is giving you. They've decided to give that up. That puts more pressure on you to make a shot. But then also maybe it was the injuries. I mean, Carroll was playing on one leg. Korver was out these last two games. Horford, I think, was pretty banged up. You know, he had a bunch of incidences where people kind of fell into his leg, or he kind of came down awkwardly and was limping around. You know, he didn't look like nearly as spry by the end of this series as he had in the Washington series when he had some wonderful defensive performances. You know, Millsap couldn't shoot, so maybe you hope that they'll be a little better. I mean, and I don't really see much of a course for them other than to try and bring these guys back and hope maybe you get a little internal improvement or guys can maintain, even though you don't necessarily expect that next year, because you know, this is a 60-win team. I mean, what's your option other than bringing these guys back and maybe trying to add to the core just a little bit?
Agreed. What concerned me more about their playoff run was actually the Nets series, because that was a team that I thought they just had so many advantages over, and to see them have to struggle both within games and in the series as a whole was more concerning than that a depleted team getting beat by Cleveland.
Yeah, I mean, and this Cleveland team, maybe we'll find out finally in the finals whether it's just the weak East or whether this team we should are wrongfully continuing to underestimate them. And we should probably turn to them now, because what they've done here, I mean, when you found out that Kevin Love was going to be out, I think we talked about who the favorite was. We may have made them a mild favorite. There are definitely times in the Bulls series, especially once Kyrie became hobbled, that I thought the Bulls were going to win that series. And then, you know, I picked the Hawks over them too, in large part based on Kyrie's health. And as it turned out, you know, once Carroll was injured, the Hawks weren't able to get it done. But, you know, truthfully, I'm not sure that that would have made it that much of a difference with the teams in the state that they were in, because the Hawks just couldn't quite score well enough against this Cleveland team. So that's really where you start, is what they've been able to do defensively after just having, you know, it's very difficult for me to remember another team with no history of being good on defense that improved this much in the playoffs. I mean, maybe the last one you could look at would be the 0-1 Lakers, who were not very good during the regular season and then turned it on, but they had been a great defense previously and kind of were coasting through the regular season. I don't think that that's what this team was doing.
And in terms of personnel, it's surprising too. I mean, even if you want to say replacing Kyrie with Dellavedova, which had some that spillover benefits because Dellavedova brings energy and all of that, there isn't a core on this team. You go, oh, they just need to activate those guys. And while Kevin Love is not the greatest defender in the world, the switch from Love to Thompson, to me, didn't seem like the type of thing that would cause this kind of improvement.
Yeah, but I think, you know, maybe you would have to say that it did. And Thompson, we talked about him last night. You just, the thing about him is that he really, against all but some of the largest matchups, and they don't really have any of those in the East, frankly, you know, it's not, other than Brook Lopez and maybe Jonas Valanciunas, there are not like a ton of centers that Tristan Thompson is going to struggle to guard one-on-one. And the post game is, you know, becoming somewhat of an anachronism. Although Zach Lowe wrote a nice piece saying, you know, it's still going to be important, but more from a mismatch standpoint. So Thompson really can hold up defensively now as a center, and that works well with his center offensive game. And of course, his amazing offensive rebounding, he's not asked to do that much offensively, and when all you're doing is concentrating on getting position for the offensive glass, you can start doing your work early against guys who also have help responsibilities, and that's, you know, that and his tireless work and, you know, real good hands and just really strong lower body is what enables him to get so many offensive rebounds, because he plays off of the other threats that they have on that team and people worried about helping.
Yeah, he's been, it's hard to use the word revelation, but how he has fit into this team has been massively surprising to me in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, people had talked about him having had a better year than a lot of people realized, but I kind of discounted that because overall their defense wasn't that great, but he clearly wasn't the problem with it. I mean, or either he's playing better, and I'm sure maybe he is playing a little bit better in the playoffs, but yeah, I think he's really been just a massive key for them.
Do you want to? Is there anything more you want to say on Cleveland, or do we want to save that for later because they have more games?
Yeah, no, I think there is a lot to say because, you know, and especially this may be as close as it gets to a coronation of Cleveland, at least as Eastern Conference champions. David Black, can we talk about what he's done? I mean, I was thinking about it the other day, and he and the Golden State staff are really the two coaching staffs that have done very little wrong that I can really point to. I mean, now obviously you and I are not the like sole arbiters of what's good coaching and bad coaching, but and there's always going to be some selection bias when the team wins. You're not going to focus as much on their mistakes. But I can really only point to a couple things that I thought, you know, could have done better. And that was, you know, starting off with Kyrie on Rose every game in the Bulls series before he switched to the real matchup with Shumpert. But yeah, it was, he's done really well, I think. I mean, you can't, and you know, there was the timeout thing too, but you know, in the grand scheme of things, that's not that important when you're talking about preparing your team to play and, you know, the lineup choices that you're making. And he's gotten this team to defend. They've really improved their defensive scheme. They were hedging a ton early in the season. They scrapped that. They had the bigs laying back now. They did do a lot of switching now, and it's been really, really effective. And, you know, you can say, well, that's Tyronn Lue, LeBron James is the real coach, whatever. Well, you know, if we're going to blame someone like Blatt when things go poorly, and we're going to blame other coaches when things go poorly and credit them when things go well, even if they have a great staff, I think that David Blatt does have to get a lot of credit.
He does. And one of the ways that I was thinking about this is that I would say most people, definitely myself, thought that the Cavs were a top-heavy team. They were a team that relied a lot on their big three, and the other guys, they had good supporting players. They had guys that had talent, but they relied heavily to generate particularly offense from those guys. They have been missing one of those entirely for the last two series, and the other one has been severely limited, and they have still done a good job. And that is incredibly impressive to me, because there are very few teams that can weather that kind of storm. And yes, having LeBron James certainly helps. But a lot of credit has to go to everyone involved. It has to go to the other players for stepping up, and it has to go to the coaching staff for using a guy like Tristan Thompson in the way that they did, to have him play both power forward and center and be willing to use him to spell Mozgov in these last two series is huge. And that's been a big factor in why they've succeeded.
Yeah, and they also have done a good job of just going away from things that didn't work. Like, they started Mike Miller in that Bulls series. They realized it didn't work, and they just got away from it. And, you know, they went to James Jones. He has been really effective, even though he, you know, Mike Miller is the guy that they gave the mid-level or the room exception to, you know, so.
And they went away from Sean Marion, too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he was another one. I mean, those guys are veterans that they brought in thinking they were going to play a big role. James Jones was almost a total afterthought. He barely played the last couple of years in Miami, but he ended up playing a key role, was a huge threat spacing the floor and making jump shots. And, you know, Marion and Miller were ineffective, and Blatt had the courage to go away from them, even though, you know, they were probably brought in and promised to have a pretty big role this year.
Yeah, I would imagine that they were. And as you mentioned, they're guys that have had a lot of success. They're both champions, and you talk about that. James Jones is too as well. But the Cavs have done a really nice job. And I've also been really impressed with guys like Amon Shumpert. I think that people have talked about J.R. Smith because his scoring is so ridiculous at times. But I thought Shumpert was a huge factor in this series as well.
Yeah, he's someone who they just desperately needed to have someone other than LeBron, who, you know, is really only a stopper type when he gets locked in towards the end of the game due to his offensive responsibilities. And he's also, we should give him some credit. He's been defending much, much better in these playoffs, than he was early on in the year when, you know, he really was not locked in at all. So he deserves a lot of credit for the defensive improvement. But yeah, I think when they, you know, making that trade just rejuvenated everyone, and whether it was David Griffin, whether it's Dan Gilbert, frankly, who, you know, is reviled in some quarters, but he's going to pay, you know, he paid the luxury tax this year. He's going to pay a crap load more next year, very likely, if they keep this team together. So he deserves some credit as well. Not a lot of owners would necessarily green light taking on that level of salary. Although, of course, his hand may have somewhat been forced by the fact that LeBron is a free agent coming up, and wouldn't have been happy about it the way he was unhappy about the Mike Miller amnesty in Miami if Gilbert had engaged in any perceived penny pinching.
This team did something that I can't recall happening, at least in this current CBA, which is that they cleared enough space to sign LeBron and to use the room exception and then still paid the luxury tax.
Yeah,
that is
funny.
It is
yeah.
Very hard to do that.
There's, you know, you're hard capped at the apron if you use the biannual exception or if you use the mid-level exception, but you're not hard capped if you use the room exception. I would guess the reason for that is that the framers, as it were, probably didn't ever anticipate that it would be possible to use the Ruma section, which means you were under the cap and you used cap space, and then still get over the luxury tax in the same season.
Yeah, and they used it in ways that will also yield benefits. I'm sure we'll talk about it in the future, but Haywood's contract is a piece that can actually help them get better regardless of what happens otherwise.
Yeah, we'll see if they use that. I would be a little surprised, but yeah, again, that's a topic for another day. One other piece of news that came out of the post-game locker room, Millsap, of course, is a free agent, and his quote, basically, I'm paraphrasing here, was that the Hawks' togetherness and their culture would be a big factor in his decision of whether to return or not. Obviously, the money's going to have to be right there, but that's at least somewhat encouraging for Hawks fans who don't want to lose their power forward.
Yeah, he's a huge piece, and he's one of those guys that would be largely irreplaceable if he left because of the structure of that team, and we'll talk about that at a later date.
All right, anything else on this game?
Not on this game, but there are some other pieces of news that I'm sure we'll hit.
Yeah, I mean, the one that I saw, Casey Johnson's been a beat reporter for the Chicago Tribune on the Bulls, has been doing some nice reporting on the Thibodeau situation. His report today indicated we discussed on yesterday's show the idea of Tibbs' contract having an offset. And in fact, they do have an offset. So if he goes somewhere else, then that will offset the money that the Bulls owe him. That might be a reason why he doesn't necessarily want to jump into something else, but also a reason why, you know, they would not want to, or they would not be basically against him going somewhere else. They would probably want that to happen because then the costs that they owe him would be defrayed. But, you know, it seems like they're not really getting any kind of offers. I don't know where that's going to materialize from. And the other thing that Johnson reported was, you know, and I'm not sure whether this is sourced or whether it's his own read on the situation, was that money that remains would not be an issue in them firing him, if that's what the direction they decide to go in.
Yeah, the reporting is fascinating to me because of how it relates to what we had already heard about them possibly holding him out. I mean, some of that is a leverage play, but if they were able to defray the costs, you would think that would lead them towards opening up the door for another job, especially if they can get compensation.
Yeah, but, you know, I think that they just, part of the problem, too, in terms of potentially getting compensation is that everyone believes he's going to get fired anyway. So maybe their leverage, that's why they're holding on to him, is to say, look, you know what, like, if you want him for this year, you're going to have to compensate because otherwise we're just going to, you know, let him twist in the wind. But, you know, they need to get their own guy in there, too, so you can't just continue doing that forever and ever and ever, because either they would lose out on their own candidates or they just need a guy who's going to be around for the draft and free agency and summer league and, you know, just having a coach in place to plan for next year.
Yeah. The other piece of news that we talked about on yesterday's show, and you were right and I was wrong, Dwight Howard's flagrant foul was not upgraded to a flagrant 2, and President of Basketball Operations Rod Thorne classified it that the hit was unnecessary but not excessive. To me, that reads as something when you wanted a certain outcome and you say that, because it was, I don't see how something that is unnecessary that hits somebody in the face is not excessive. Maybe that's just me, I especially considering it wasn't like Dwight was reaching for the ball or something. Thorne claimed that it was that he was trying to extricate his arm, which I chuckled a little bit at because that's not why you hit somebody in the face. But at the same time, I can whine about the result, but what we're getting is Dwight Howard playing in Game 5, which is good for the series.
Yeah, I think so. I do see, unlike a lot of people, I do see what the difference is between Horford and Howard, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because this is one of the less interesting. I mean, this is this is more like our lawyer jobs than like actual basketball analysis, but the difference is that Howard swung rather recklessly, but it was in the process of trying to extricate himself from Bogut, who had kind of made a cheaper play maybe even than Dellavedova did beforehand. And whereas Horford, his like people's elbow maneuver had no possible purpose. There's no real variation on intent there. Like, he clearly was trying to make Dellavedova feel a little bit or a lot of pain, depending on your perspective, and intentionally landed on him and then did the old, oh, I didn't do anything, you know, hold your hands up, which only served to make him feel look more guilty, unfortunately. But, I think that because Howard was kind of tangled up and he did recklessly throw that arm and it was clearly out of frustration, there was at least somewhat of a reasonable explanation for it other than just, I am trying to hurt you. You know, so that's the difference I see. I mean, you're really splitting hairs here. Frankly, I'm glad that he's going to be in there. To me, suspensions are much more about deterrent effect than, you know, any kind of real justice for a team or player, unless you really just like sock someone in the face and injure them badly, like
Jay Crowder.
Yeah, like happened to Jay Crowder with J.R. Smith. So I'm happy he's playing. I didn't think Horford should have been thrown out anyway myself. But, you know, on the other hand, there's been a lot of black eyes for the league, and they're still perhaps rightly terrified of a Kermit Washington, like Rudy Tomjanovich type of situation of punches being thrown, or like that huge fight that happened in like 1994 with the Bulls and Knicks right in front of David Stern with JoJo English and Derek Harper. So, you know, I see why they do it that way, but it's certainly, as someone who's watching the games and, you know, just believes in sportsmanship and winning in you know, against the best possible opponent, you know, I don't think any competitor wants to win because someone got suspended unless they do something truly, truly egregious.
Yeah. Do you want to move on to questions?
Yeah, why don't we do that? We haven't had a chance to do that in a while.
We're going to have some time now.
Yeah, depending on what happens tomorrow night. So here's a good one. Where would you rank – this is from Adam_Peck7. Where would you rank the Cavs if they were in the West?
So I interpreted this as at the beginning of the postseason, so healthy versus largely healthy. And I definitely would have had them below the Warriors, the Clippers, and the Spurs. I think I would have had them below the Rockets. That was right around where I had them. Also remember that Memphis came into the playoffs with Allen and Conley hurt. They weren't seriously hurt, but they were hurt enough to cause that. They would definitely be above the Blazers, and I thought the Mavericks were a train wreck. So above them, and I would have had them above the Pelicans because the Pelicans were limited. So I think that puts them at fourth, and you could argue fifth.
Yeah, I would actually put them in the same tier as the Spurs and Clippers, frankly, when they were fully healthy. And I think when you look at what some of their role players have been able to do with Love out and with Kyrie out, I think that makes sense. I interpreted it differently, actually. I thought, you know, what is this present version of the Cavs? Where would you put them kind of in the West when you consider the way that all of those teams kind of finished? I would have them below the Clippers, below the Rockets, probably, because I actually still kind of think the Clippers were a little better than the Rockets. Sorry, Houston. Spurs, Clippers, probably right around Memphis. Maybe probably a better team than Memphis, just due to the fact that I don't think Memphis could score against this team at all. Maybe fourth or fifth.
Yeah, one that I liked was from Red 15 Blue, and gets into something that we'll talk about a little bit later, but what contract would you pay Tristan Thompson, and what do you expect him to get? And we've already talked about this, but how has your opinion of him changed in the playoffs?
Yeah, so we did talk about how the opinion of him has changed. I thought that that four-year, $52 million offer that he was reported to have gotten was pretty astronomical. As it turned out, that probably would have been a bargain had he accepted it. And, I mean, let's see, how old is he now? So he just turned 24. You know, I think I would not offer him the max if I were Cleveland, because you think that, you know, especially now that his agent is saying there's all this interest elsewhere, see if someone else makes a max offered him in restricted free agency, then you get the lower raises, and at least but you might also say, hey, we want to get him locked up for 5 years instead of four, with him only being 24. You really get him for his prime years in that respect. So I think my offer would probably be something along like maybe $14 million annual value over a five-year deal, and then say, all right, if you can beat that in free agency, go for it. That would probably be my approach, I think. you know, assuming that the luxury tax issues are not an issue, I think that's a fair offer for what he's been able to do, since he's basically, you know, proved himself to be about a starting center in this league and someone who could potentially get a little better. Although, you know, I don't expect him to ever really develop much of a jumper. So that's really the kind of the way that he would improve. But, you know, his defensive execution, he could get even better at that potentially. So yeah, I mean, I think, that's kind of the going rate for, a guy who's a starting center and has the type of defensive versatility that he does.
I like your number a lot. I think that it's pretty close to that. And unlike for some of the other free agents, the Cavs are in a nice situation with him because he's restricted. So they can let it play out. And with Thompson, as opposed to some of the other players that are in this free agency, the prospect of him getting, let's say, like a three-year deal with a player option at the end of it isn't so catastrophic that you would make sure that you have to lock him up. I do think that it's nice to do it, especially if you're in a situation like Cleveland where they have the money. You know, they're not going to have flexibility probably in the near term anyway. So I think 14 is a pretty nice place to put it. I think what that is it's a contract that he would reasonably consider accepting. And I think that's exactly where you should put your first offer.
Yeah, I mean, when you haven't made big, big money, he was the number four pick, so he's made some pretty good money already, but not, you know, absolutely crazy money. Maybe you can say, all right, we're giving you this fifth year. That's to guarantee that. You know, the cap is going up, though, and there's also the possibility that he could sign an offer sheet like Chandler Parsons did. For you, any offer sheet you sign has to be at least 2 years guaranteed, but he could sign a 3 year deal with that third year a player option, and then they potentially lose him. So that's the downside of not immediately offering to max him out. But I think, you know, you want to see whether that offer is there or not, and whether that fifth year means something to him or not. See how the negotiations go, but I think that would be where I would go, and then I'd say, all right, if you can get an offer to beat that, go for it.
Yeah. Do you want pick a question?
Yeah. Let's see here. So this one is from T-Cash Padgett. What needs to happen for the Hawks to actually play Hawks basketball in the playoffs next year? What do you think, Danny?
Be healthy first and foremost. And I would say that it would be nice if they could have another guy off their bench that could make it so that they didn't have to play their starters to, you know, really do the issues that they didn't have any faith in their bench. And so you had to stagger their starters a little bit, because as we talked about throughout the playoffs, that five-man unit did really well. And I think that anything that they can do, and they do have a pretty solid draft pick to do that, to try to build up that bench, because as long as they can keep that five-man unit together, I think that's Hawks basketball, and so you do that by giving more guys that Budenholzer can trust.
You know who they really could have used in these playoffs is a bit of a non sequitur? Lou Williams, who they basically for nothing ended up being the sixth man of the year in Toronto, but another guy you had to guard in the perimeter who could get his own shot. Granted, you know, not the greatest defender. They also ended up using that room to get Cephalosha, who ultimately didn't help in the playoffs. And I think even though Cephalosha is a good defender, you can say that Lou Williams is certainly a better offensive player. You know, Lou Williams didn't fit what they were trying to do, which was Hawks basketball, basically, with a lot of moving the ball and no holding it, not a lot of one-on-one creation. But as it turned out, that's what they needed to do in the playoffs, especially because teams switched on them a lot and they weren't able to make them pay that well. So they could have used him ultimately, and you know, he had been coming off a torn ACL last year. He wasn't nearly this type of player, and there was no guarantee he was going to get back to that. But, I thought he's a better player than Cephalosha to me, so they could have used him. But so maybe, you know, playing Hawks basketball, the Spurs managed to play that kind of basketball and do well against quite a variety of opponents the previous year. I think that they just need guys to hit more shots. That's ultimately what it boils down to is those guys who are 35% shooters, they need to get hot. And then that opens up the middle. And you would think that they played a lot more Hawks basketball if Paul Millsap, Pero Antic, Mike Scott, if those guys could have hit a three-pointer, Teague, Schroeder, if they shot at their regular season rates, maybe we wouldn't be talking about how they didn't play Hawks basketball.
I would also say that with the comparison with the Spurs, while their gameplay similarities, I think that the Spurs' aggregate talent level is substantially higher than the Hawks.
And
both from a depth perspective and from a high-end talent perspective, and that makes it a lot easier to succeed against a variety of opponents, because when you have not only the Hall of Famers, people talk about that, but guys like Kawhi Leonard, who is an incredibly good basketball player, that gives you the versatility to face these teams. And one of the questions that I have for you, I guess, is Thabo obviously would have helped the Hawks in this series in particular. But how do you reconcile his minutes in this series with the other guys, assuming that Korver doesn't get hurt?
Yeah, I don't really think he would have helped that much, to be honest. I mean, like, he shoots 32% from three. He takes an hour to get his shot off. Their biggest problem up until the last game was that they just couldn't score the way they had. And that was really their biggest problem, I thought, throughout the playoffs. The defense, I thought, was pretty good other than the fact that they couldn't get a rebound. And I don't think Cephalosha would have helped too much in that regard. So, yeah, I mean, it was, to me, he would have just hurt the offense even more. He might have even, you know, you got to remember, he couldn't even get on the floor for Oklahoma City by the end of the playoffs last year. The Spurs just weren't even guarding him. And the Cavs certainly had absolutely zero qualms about leaving dudes open who couldn't shoot. That's another thing that Blatt deserves some credit for, was that strategy of saying, all right, you know, prove that you can beat us. And I think he got in the Hawks' head a little bit with that.
Yeah, I agree, and I think the best argument for Thabo is that he's another body to throw at LeBron, but as you said, I don't think that's the reason they lost.
Well, and he's pretty skinny, too. I don't know that he would have been, I mean, he's a good defensive player, but if LeBron decides to back him down, I don't think he would have had all that much success there either. So it's, I don't think that he was quite the panacea that people were talking about. Like, what happened to him, by all accounts, appears like it's pretty tragic, but I'm not sure that he would have made that big of a difference, even if they were a little bit more healthy than it turned out that they were.
One question that we got asked before, and the same person asked it again, Eric Stewart, is now that we've gotten further along, do you feel this is the weakest East of LeBron's playoff career?
And he responded with, I say yes. And I will agree with you, Eric, because really when you consider Gasol's injury, I thought that that would ultimately help the Bulls do the player usage, but you know, he also made second team All-NBA. He's not a bad player. That made things a lot easier. The Hawks were a mash unit,
and the Celtics were a very low quality playoff team.
Yeah, they were too. I mean, they weren't really, you know, any kind of great shakes as an opponent. And even Washington, you know, maybe Washington beats the Hawks if John Wall is healthy throughout that series, and maybe they give the Cavs a little bit better of a game than the Hawks did, potentially. Who knows? But, yeah, I mean, when you consider all the injuries and the fact that these teams weren't really any good to begin with, other than the Hawks, I think that it's probably right. I mean, that 2012 was pretty darn weak. I mean, they were playing the four seed once Rose went out. But that was, I think that this is pretty close to that. And when you consider that this team that won it, that just does not have much in the way of offensive talent, to create other than LeBron.
Yeah. Any other questions you want to hit?
No, I think that's it. Why don't we get to, our recommendations? One thing I can recommend is, your AMA that you're doing tomorrow on Reddit.
Yeah. So I'm on RMBA. I'm doing an AMA tomorrow at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern. It should be fun. Feel free to ask whatever you want. I've had I guess you could call it an interesting career so far. I've covered the league for 6 years, and I'd love to share whatever you guys want to ask. It'll be fun. And if you want to ask about duck-sized horses and horse-sized ducks, I'll answer that too.
All right. My recommendation, outside of Danny's AMA, is one of my favorite authors, maybe my favorite author, Pat Conroy. Two great books that have a little bit of a basketball theme to them. One is My Losing Season. It's a nonfiction about his senior year at the Citadel, when he was a point guard. Really one of the better basketball books that I've ever read. And then maybe my favorite book is called The Great Santini. Fantastic book. You may have seen the movie, which came out in the late 70s. The book's even better. Really, really funny. Kind of like the American Beauty, if you like that movie, of books. You know, really funny, but also extremely profound and, you know, beautifully written as well. So, yeah, there you go. That's my recommendation for today.
My recommendation for today is one of my favorite podcasts. It's called How Did This Get Made? It's Paul Scheer, Jason Mantzoukas, and June Diane Raphael, and they're all comics. They all have that background, and it's them talking about mostly bad movies. They do some awesome ones. My opinion on Con Air is that it is awesome. But I like the dynamic of it, and they actually get insightful. One of my favorite things is them talking about the destruction that is happening in, let's say, action movies like the Fast and Furious movies. For me, that just puts me in a fun mental state when I see them in the future. And it's something to make me laugh, and I enjoy it a lot, and I think you will too.
All right, well, that'll wrap us up for tonight. Thanks again for listening. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Nate Duncan, NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. Please subscribe if you want to on iTunes. You can also find the XML link if you have another podcast player you want to use at the Real GM page. We hopefully are prominently featured there and easy to find. But we will talk to y'all next time after Game 5 of Warriors Houston. Till then.